The top comment is, "Oh, I thought a water buffalo was just a buffalo that is always around water. Had no idea they were fish."
I don't think that's what it means.
Well, this water buffalo is literally like crocodiling in the river.
Okay, but how many crocodiles do you know are fish?
There. There. You're not wrong.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the show. I'm Blair.
And I'm Kirsten, and we are
Mediocre Content.
And surrounded by cats as usual.
Yes.
It was
we
very
love
quiet
it.
For a while.
Yeah.
Yeah. In the
Jinx,
hour that we
Jinx
to get
likes
ready.
It when I'm on the phone or like talking to someone. I don't know why that is.
The attention is diverted.
Yeah. He thinks I'm not paying attention to him so he can do whatever he wants, and that's not true. It's not true.
Are you sure?
I will say my mom's like, it's like having a toddler, because like
Yeah.
every time I got on the phone when you guys were kids, you would inevitably need me for something.
Absolutely. In
So
fact,
it's
you save up the needs
for when she's
until
on the
that's
phone.
right. And on the phone, needing to go somewhere, talking to someone. I mean, we've got priorities.
Right.
Oh my goodness. He's like, oh, okay. He's headbutting the microphone for those
Yeah.
of you who don't know and cannot
Yeah.
see the magic.
He likes to hit his head against things. I think it causes micro concussions, but we'll see how it goes as he ages.
We're not concerned at all by the crazy eyes either.
Yeah, it like sometimes all you hear is like a thud, and you're like, did you just hit your head on the kitchen table? He's like,
Ouch.
yeah, and it felt good.
Again, I will have more. We are not encouraging you to smack your head on things. Please don't do that. That's very
No.
dangerous and can cause concussions.
That's right.
I feel like that's a
That's
good
right.
segue into our disclaimer.
All right. So we are not experts on anything. And this particular episode, we're talking about pottery. And I have taken three pottery classes and one in college. So just, take it with a grain of salt. I do the best I can. I don't know anything, like everything about this subject, but I am familiar with it. We are the place to learn about things, but please make sure you do your own research because, like I just said, we don't know everything and we don't claim to know everything. We're just out here,
Yes.
talking into the
That's what it feels like sometimes, for sure.
Kirsten, tell me some good news, please.
Oh, do I have good news? And it's about one of my favorite topics.
Hockey.
Yes. Hello, if you're new here, my name is Kirsten and I really enjoy the NHL and the AHL. So, I have good
Which,
hockey news.
honestly, knowing you since college, that was not the sport I thought you were going to be into.
Did you have one that you thought I would have instead?
I mean, if you count like ballet as a sport, because
Okay.
it is like incredibly difficult.
Fair.
But like as a nationally recognized sport,
Sure.
I think if I had to pick one for you, I just didn't see you as much of a sport girl. Maybe like equestrian. I don't know,
Okay.
because you
I
did like
did.
do that.
I
So I
did
don't
do
know.
that. I do like equestrian material and I do follow a lot of ballets, but for some
Yeah.
reason, the absolute violence and speed that is hockey
She
has
craves violence,
I
guys.
crave violence. It's just something about it. I
That's
don't
fair.
know. Yeah.
All right.
I can't ice skate, so that's also very impressive.
Yeah, neither can I. I have ice skated, but it's never gone
Oh
great.
yeah, I have skated on ice. I don't know if I've ice skated.
That's fair. Yep, that's correct.
Okay, all right. So hockey is great. We've got the season going on right now, and we have some good news coming out of this previous October, where word broke that the owner of the NHL team representing the Tampa Bay Lightning, which is in Florida, in Tampa, Florida, was selling up. Millions were coming his way through a pair of money managers from New York set to take over during the next 3 years, and the affair seemed like business as usual. However, Lightning owner Jeff Vinnick is anything but usual, and in an email that was both a surprise and not a surprise, he informed the 300 full-time employees of the Jeff Vinnick Sports Group that they would be sharing his profits. And if you don't know, owners of pretty much any sport league or sport team, they make quite a bit of money, even after taxes.
Yes.
$20 million, for example, in farewell bonuses would be split between them, depending on conditions currently unreported, but the email stipulated that the minimum amount would be 50,000 US doll hairs.
Wow.
Yeah. This is not the first time Vinnick has opened his bank account for the sake of others either, with GNN reporting all the way back in 2011 that he had donated $10 million to deserving community heroes and charity partners in the Tampa Bay area. It's amazing.
Very nice.
Joe Romano at the Tampa Bay Times got an exclusive interview with Bryce Boys after the news of the sale, and the email disclosing the bonuses made it to the press. At the time of Vinnick's takeover, the Bolts were nearly insolvency and were losing both on and off the ice. It was during the 2008 financial crisis when Florida was one of the hardest hit states. The GM recounted a conversation he had with Vinnick, first bought the franchise when nearing bankruptcy, losing connections with fans, and managing one of the worst records in the NHL. Vinnick saw an opportunity to do some good. In the wake of the worst hurricane season to hit Florida in recent times, what wouldn't someone do to have $50,000? You know, I mean,
so true.
Yeah. Specifically, we're talking about Hurricane Helene. The Amalie Arena was used as a collection point during the first two home games, with fans encouraged to bring in non-perishable foods, cleaning and baby supplies, hygiene products, and other household necessities to donate to victims of the hurricane. The collections have been completed and, of course, donated to Feeding Tampa Bay, Metropolitan Ministries, and the University Area Community Development Corporation, which is a mouthful. The Lightning Foundation also donated $2 million to these relief efforts. So if you are not a Tampa Bay Lightning fan for whatever reason, maybe you should be, because they do a lot of charity work and are really helping to support and assist their community. So
yeah, very cool.
Go team. Anyway, on a less serious note, the next one I titled Hungry, Hungry Space Hole. So you're welcome.
Yikes.
It is both space news and not suggestive, unfortunately. It's actually just kind of horrifying. A team of U.S. National Science Foundation astronomers have discovered a supermassive black hole at the center of an early galaxy.
Wait.
The song by Muse, the lightning scene, the baseball scene from Twilight.
Okay.
Come on. No, it's all right.
Sorry. Super massive. Oh.
Okay. I want the ha ha ha.
That's not the same song, but it, you know, anyway.
It's fine.
Anyway, if you've seen the Twilight movie, you understand what we're talking about. Anyway, go ahead. Go ahead.
You can't ever talk about black holes without a little bit of a giggle anyway. But they found one. In an early galaxy. This is 1.5 billion years after the Big Bang, not the show, the event, that is consuming matter at a phenomenal rate. Indeed, the black hole appears to be consuming matter at over 40 times the theoretical limit that we have established for whatever reason. According to data, specifically from the James Webb Telescope, which we have talked about, as well as the Chandra X-ray Observatory, which I don't know if we've actually talked about on this podcast or not. We have talked a lot of space, though. The black hole's extreme feast could help astronomers at the NOR lab explain how supermassive black holes grew so quickly in the early universe. Supermassive black holes exist at the center of most galaxies, and modern telescopes continue to observe them at surprisingly early times in the universe's evolution. It's difficult to understand how these were able to grow so big so rapidly. However, now we have valuable new insights into the mechanisms because of discovering this new one. LID-568 was discovered by a team led by International Gemini Observatory and in conglomeration with NSF NOR Lab. astronomer Haiyuan Su, who examined a sample of galaxies from the Chandra Cosmos Legacy Survey. If you want to know more about that, definitely just look up Chandra Cosmos Legacy Survey. The galaxies are very bright in the X-ray part of the spectrum, but are invisible in the optical and near infrared. The James Webb Telescope's unique infrared sensitivity allows it to detect these faint counterpart emissions, which is why you need both. The black hole stood out within the sample for its intense X-ray emission, but its exact position could not be determined from the X-ray observations alone. So rather than using traditional slit spectroscopy, my lord, scientists suggested that Su's team use the integral field spectrograph on the James Webb Telescope. This is an instrument that can get a spectrum for each pixel in the instrument's field of view rather than being limited to a narrow slice, which is helpful. They were able to view it and its surrounding region, leading to the unexpected discovery with powerful outflows of gases around the central black hole. And if you've never seen one of these, I would highly suggest looking it up. It's very cool. It is like a solid black hole, but around it, it has like these colorful fields that, I mean, the color has been imprinted on it with the X-ray and the photograph, but you can actually see the movement and the gases outlining the holes, and it's very cool. The speed and size of these outflows led the team to infer that it's a single episode of rapid accretion. Quote, "This serendipitous result added a new dimension to our understanding of the system and opened up exciting avenues for investigation," end quote. And that is by Su. The Eddington limit relates to the maximum luminosity that a black hole can achieve, as well as how fast it can absorb the matter. And this is what we've been basing a lot of our research on and a lot of our previous black hole discoveries on. And this is such that its inward gravitational force and outward pressure generated from the heat of the compressed infalling matter remain completely in balance. When LID-568's luminosity was calculated to be so much higher than theoretically possible, the team knew, obviously, they found something remarkable in their data. These results provide new insights into the formation of supermassive black holes from the smaller hold, quote, seeds, this is what they call them, which current theories suggest arise either from the death of the universe's first stars or light seeds, or the direct collapse of gas clouds, which are considered heavy seeds. Until now, these theories lacked complete observational confirmation, and now with this discovery, we have it. If you're interested, this discovery was published in the paper in Nature Astronomy, so you are more than welcome to take a look at that and read up on it. It's pretty cool. It's also kind of terrifying to think that this thing is just out there eating the universe or whatever. But don't panic, I guess, is the end of that good news.
I'm so glad I didn't panic. I'm
so glad we didn't panic. And that's all I have.
Wonderful.
Yeah.
Claps for Kirsten.
Oh, snaps. You got to do the snaps. I don't even know if this microphone will pick up snaps because you're... Oh! I got one of your snaps.
Maybe. I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know. Your mic's too good.
She's $20 off Amazon, so I don't really know what to tell you.
She's carrying this podcast. That's what she's
literally
doing.
Single-handedly. Single mom who works two jobs.
Loves her kids and never stops.
All right. Jinx is once again moving my monitor for
it
fun.
I kind of feel like you're in an earthquake, but I'm also trying not to think about it too much.
It's not an earthquake. It's just Jinx because he likes the way the corner of the monitor feels against his cheek.
Oh, he's scenting it. Great.
Yeah. I don't know what to tell you.
Yeah, I got to cover this in my cat spit. Delicious. Gross.
All right. So today we're going to talk about pottery, which is, in fact, one of the oldest and most widespread of the decorative arts, consisting of objects made of clay and hardened with heat. The objects made are commonly useful ones, which I believe there is a slight distinction. It just depends on who you talk to between pottery and ceramics.
Okay.
Ceramics
typically refers to the pottery that is, or like clay made items that are useful, like for, so like plates, cups,
Sure.
silverware, or not silverware, but like eating utensils, that kind of stuff. And like pottery is more for like, all right, I'm kicking Jinx off. Hold on 1 minute. His tail is like way too distracting. Hold on.
This is like, it's recorded, but why cut it out? It's too funny.
Okay. So ceramics is like usable everyday items, and then pottery is also that, but it's more decorative. So like, and I don't know, again, not an expert. I don't really know if that's true, but like for the intents and purposes of this particular article and like where I got this information, they just refer to pottery as like an umbrella term for all of that stuff. Okay.
Fun.
All right. First we're going to talk about clay. All right.
Okay.
Clay is the basic material of pottery. It has two distinctive characteristics. It's plastic, i.e., it can be molded and will retain shape. So, plastic in this particular sense is like we're using it as a descriptive term and not like the actual plastic that you're thinking of right now.
Interesting. Is that the actual definition of plastic?
I believe so.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
So pottery also, so it's moldable, but then once you put it under a high level of heat, it hardens, and can form a brittle but otherwise virtually indestructible material that is not attacked by any of the agents that corrode metals or organic materials. And this is why we find a lot of pottery from like ancient civilizations still, because it's not like they heated it up under high heat and it's not going anywhere.
Nice.
Firing also protects the clay body against the effects of water. If a sun-dried clay vessel is filled with water, it'll eventually collapse. But if it's heated, chemical changes will begin to take place around 900 degrees Fahrenheit or 500 degrees Celsius. Prelude.
Sorry.
Kirsten's being attacked by her cat. Preclude. A return to the plastic state, no matter how much water is later in contact with it. Clay is a refractory substance. It will vitrify only at temperatures of about 2,900 degrees Fahrenheit or 1,600 degrees Celsius. If it's mixed with a substance that will vitrify at a lower temperature, the mixture will is subjected to heat of this order. And the clay will hold the object in shape while the other substance vitrifies. This forms a non-porous opaque body known as stoneware. When feldspar or soapstone is added to the clay and exposed to a temperature of 2000 to 2650 degrees Fahrenheit, the product becomes translucent and is known as porcelain. In this section, earthenware is used to denote all pottery substances that are not vitrified and therefore slightly porous and coarser than vitrified materials. Okay.
Nice.
Okay. Okay. So the line of demarcation between the two classes, so you have earthenware and you have your like porcelain, basically. The line of demarcation between the two classes of vitrified material, which is stoneware and porcelain, is extremely vague. So, in the Western world, porcelain is usually defined as a translucent substance when held to the light. Most porcelain does have this property, and stoneware is regarded as partially vitrified material that's not translucent. The Chinese, on the other hand, define porcelain as a ceramic material that will give a ringing tone when tapped. None of these definitions is completely satisfactory. For instance, some thinly potted stonewares are slightly translucent if they've been fired at a high temperature, whereas some heavily potted porcelains are opaque. So therefore, the application of the term is really just like whatever you want it to be. Because like, think about a toilet. A toilet is porcelain, but it's definitely not
opaque, or it's definitely not translucent.
I guess I've
So,
never thought about that before.
yeah. Anyway, so earthenware was the first kind of pottery made, dating back to about 900 year or 9,000 years. In the 21st century, it is widely used. The earthenware body varies in color from buff to dark red and from gray to black. The body can be covered and decorated with slip, which is a mixture of clay and water, which we'll talk about later. And it's like kind of a creamy consistency. Think about like buttercream, that kind of thing, if you're doing a cake situation.
Except don't eat
Don't, yeah, definitely don't do that.
it. Gross.
Used for adhesive and casting as well as for decoration. With a clear glaze or with an opaque tin glaze. Tin glazed earthenware is usually called majolica or Delft. So we'll talk about that with decorative glazing a little bit. If the clear glazed earthenware body is a cream in color, it's called creamware. Much of the commercial earthenware produced beginning in the second half of the 20th century was heat and cold proof and could thus be used for cooking and freezing as well as for serving. Okay.
Nice.
Stoneware is our second type, really. And stoneware is very hard and, although sometimes translucent, usually opaque. The color of the body varies considerably and can be red, brown, gray, white, or black. Fine white stoneware was made in China as early as 1400, or yeah, 1400 BCE, which is the Shang Dynasty. In Korea, stoneware was first made during the Silla Dynasty in Japan during the 13th century. The first production of stoneware in Europe was in 16th century Germany. When tea was first imported to Europe from China in the 17th century, each chest was accompanied by a red stoneware pot made at the Yixing Kilns in Jiangsu in the Jiangsu province. This ware was accompanied, it was copied in Germany and the Netherlands and England. So at the end of the 17th century, English potters made salt glazed white stoneware that was regarded by them as a substitute for porcelain. In the 18th century, the Englishman Josiah Wedgwood made a black stoneware called basalts, and a white stoneware colored with metallic oxides called jasper. A fine white stoneware called ironstone china was introduced in England in the early 19th century. And in the 20th century, stoneware was used mostly by artist potters such as Bernard Leach and his followers.
Nice.
So I would venture to guess, I'm not 100% sure, that if you're in a pottery class right now, you're making stoneware.
Right. I would say that as well. Yeah.
All right, now, porcelain. The Chinese are very famous for this. So it started there during the Tang Dynasty in 16, between 1618 and nine. Girl.
Words.
This cat. All right, where was I?
Calls him girl is actually boy.
I'm
That's
sorry, I
great.
misgendered my cat. It's
No, it's fine. And
fine.
Lynx is also trying desperately to sit on my chest, and so he just kept rubbing his face on the microphone and pushing it into my mouth and just kind of haw,
Look at this. Look at this right now.
sir, please. He is just laying across her desk as if he is the mat underneath.
Right. I
Him,
can't.
not even flat, makes a terrible mat. One out of 10 stars. I don't know
Anyway,
what the, it's just something in the air today.
they're wilding out. It was a full moon last night, so maybe that.
That's fair. Why didn't you had all day yesterday, son?
All day. Just lay there, okay? Relax. Jesus.
Just lay
Just
there.
relax.
I'm so glad he didn't panic.
He's literally looking up at me like, huh, what's going on? And I'm just like, just literally just sit there.
Just talking. Oh, it's a mess.
All right.
Cats.
Where was I? Let's see.
Porcelain.
Oh.
We're talking about Chinese porcelain.
All right. So Porcelain was the first made in China during the Tang Dynasty between 1618 and 907 CE. So that was a long time ago. The kind most familiar in the West was not manufactured until the
Yuan.
Yuan, maybe. Yeah. Dynasty in 1279 or to between 1279 and 1368 CE. It was made from kaolin, which is a white china clay, and patensi, a fieldspathic rock, also called china stone, the latter being ground to a powder and mixed with the clay. During the firing, which took place at a temperature of about 2,650 degrees Fahrenheit, the patensi vitrified, while the refractory clay ensured that the vessel retained its shape.
Nice.
In the medieval times, isolated specimens of Chinese porcelain found their way to Europe, where they were much prized, principally because of their translucency. European potters made numerous attempts to imitate them, and since at that time there was not an exact body of chemical and physical knowledge whereby the porcelain could be analyzed and then synthesized, experiments proceeded strictly by analogy. The only manufactured translucent substance then known was glass, and it was perhaps inevitable that glass made opaque with tin oxide, the known the German milch glass or milk glass, for example, should have been used as a substitute for porcelain. My mom really likes milk glass. She
Yeah,
collects
it's
it.
very
It's a
pretty.
big popular thing. The nature of glass, however, made it impossible to shape by any of the means used by the potter. The mixture of clay and ground glass was eventually tried. Porcelain made it in this way resembles that of Chinese only superficially and is always termed soft or artificial porcelain. The date and place of the first attempt to make soft porcelain are debatable, but some Middle Eastern pottery of the 12th century was made from glazed material mixed with clay and is occasionally translucent. Much of the same formula was employed with a measure of success in Florence in about 1575 at workshops under the patronage of Duke Francisco de Medici. No further attempts of any kind appear to have been made until the mid 17th century when Claude and Francis Reverend, I probably didn't say that with the correct French enunciation,
You're not French. It's fine.
Paris importers of Dutch pottery were granted a monopoly of porcelain manufacture in France. It is not known whether they succeeded in making it or not, but certainly by the end of the 17th century, porcelain was being made in quantity, this time by a factory in Saint Cloud near Paris.
So, okay, really
Yes.
quickly.
Yes.
So, is porcelain the same as bone china?
We'll get there.
Okay,
We'll get there.
okay,
You're getting there.
okay,
All right. The secret of true or hard porcelain, similar to that of China, was not discovered until about 1707 in
Ah.
Saxony when Infried Water von Sternhaus,
Nailed it.
assisted by an alchemist called Johann Friedrich Jinks, I swear to God.
I saw that. Oh.
Get your little toesies off of here, please. Thank you.
No cat typing with the beans, please.
All right. Okay. Johann Friedrich Bodker substituted ground feldspathic rock for the ground glass in the soft porcelain formula. Soft porcelain, always regarded as a substitute for hard porcelain, was progressively discontinued because it was uneconomic. Kiln wastage was excessive, occasionally rising to 9/10 of the total. The term soft and hard porcelain refer to the soft firing, so that's about 2200 degrees Fahrenheit, necessary for the first, and the hard firing, about 2650 degrees Fahrenheit, necessary for the second. By coincidence, they apply also to the physical properties of the two substances. For example, soft porcelain can be cut with a file, whereas hard porcelain can't. This is sometimes used as a test for the nature of the body. So if you're, and like soft porcelain is like less valuable, et cetera, et cetera.
I see. So you just go at it with a file.
Allegedly.
Okay.
Allegedly.
I will take my file to the antique shop at once.
At once. Post haste.
Post haste.
In the course of experiments in England during the 18th century, a type of soft porcelain was made in which bone ash, a calcium Ooh. Phosphate made by roasting of bones of cattle and oh. grinding them into a fine powder, so it's not vegan, guys, was added to the ground glass. Josiah Spode, the second later, added his bone to ash to the true hard porcelain formula and the resulting body known as bone china.
So sorry, I asked.
Has since become the standard English porcelain. So it's not from China. Bone china is like fancy British porcelain.
No, it is
hard porcelain.
Disgusting.
Is strong, but its vitreous nature causes it to chip fairly easily. And unless especially treated, it is usually tinged slightly with blue or gray. Bone china is slightly easier to manufacture. It is strong and does not chip easily, and the bone ash confers an ivory white appearance widely regarded as desirable. Generally, bone china is most popular for the table services in England and the United States, while hard porcelain is preferred on the European continent.
Now I feel like I will never be able to buy bone china again, knowing how it's
Were you in the
made.
Market for some? Because
I mean, it's real pretty if you've never seen it. It's quite lovely.
It is lovely. But at what cost?
The cost of bones, literal bones. Jeez.
Into the kiln.
You know what? Actually, okay, I take that back. You know what I'm going to do? This is great. When I die, I'm going to have them grind my bones and make everyone a fancy set of plates, and they'll remember me forever.
Great. I'm looking forward to my plate.
Indeed.
All right. Honestly, I feel like a plate, really?
You don't want to eat off my plate?
No.
Would you rather sip coffee from a cup? Just a cup of Kirsten bones. Fancy. Pinkies out only, please.
I mean, I feel like there's somebody who probably does that.
Okay.
But again, it wouldn't be. So like the bone. Well. No. No.
Yeah. Okay. Are we looking for? Okay. You know what? Just send me your request of what vessel you would prefer.
And I feel like you should make me like a hair clippy thing.
A hair clip?
Yeah.
Girl.
I don't want to eat off of you. That's all I'm saying.
I could make you a vase.
A vase would be nice.
I would be so pretty with flowers in my head.
You really would. You really would.
All right, fine. You get a vase, but I'm going to make my brother eat off the plate.
I think that's reasonable.
Honestly. I think so. That's right. I paid for this and it's weird. Enjoy, Chris.
All right. So now we're going to talk a little bit, now that we know the history of the china,
mm-hmm.
not and the bone china and horrifying. The regular pottery and the stoneware, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to talk a little bit about like how we do this. Okay.
Okay.
And there are many, I'm going to preface this by saying there are many different styles of how to do pottery.
Mm-hmm.
And there's also two major types of pottery. One is wheel throwing, which I like the best. And then others is like hand building. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
I think we're going to mostly be talking about wheel throwing in this particular section. Mm-hmm. So yeah, but there's many different styles. There's many ways, as they say, there are many ways to skin a cat, but you know,
you hear that, Lynx?
Literally Jinx is sitting right in front of me. So don't get your panties in a bunch about like the styles that they talk about in this article, because you can throw pottery however you want, like whatever shape makes you feel great. Okay.
I mean, look, I know we just talked about grinding my bones into a vase, but you don't got to bring my panties into this.
I understand. We're friends though. It's fine.
True.
All right. So raw clay consists primarily of true clay particles and undecomposed feldspar mixed with other components of indigenous rocks from which it was derived. Usually appreciable quantities of quartz and small quantities of mica, iron oxides, and other substances. Okay, so this is what's fun about pottery is that, like, wherever the person mm-hmm. was, you can tell because that's mm-hmm. the kind of soil and clay that was in the ground at the time. Okay, smart. We like it. The composition and thus behavior and plasticity of clays from different sources are therefore slightly different, except for coarse earthenwares, which can be made from clay as it is found in the earth. Pottery is made from special clays plus other materials mixed to achieve the desired results. The mixture is called the clay body or the batch. Okay.
Mm.
To prepare the batch, the ingredients are combined with water and reduced to the desired degree of fineness, and this surplus of water is then removed. Okay.
Nice.
And then you add water back as you like shape the clay in order mm-hmm. to move it in the way that you want. Okay.
Makes sense.
All right. So shaping the clay, the earliest vessels were modeled by hand using the finger and the thumb, a method employed still by the Japanese to make raku tea bowls.
Have you seen those videos? I think so.
I haven't.
It's so,
I need to look at them.
It's so cool. They use like hammers and little paddles and things. It's beautiful. It's very
that's
lovely.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Flat slabs of clay luted together mm-hmm. using clay slip as an adhesive were employed to make square or oblong vessels, and the slabs could be formed into a cylinder and provided with a flat base by the same means. Coiled pottery was an early development. Long rolls of clay were coiled in a circle, layer upon layer, until the approximate shape had been attained. The walls of the vessel were then finished by scraping and smoothing. Some remarkably fine pottery, early pots were made in this way. Okay, nice. So they did a lot of hand building originally, right? Because
sense.
They didn't have any way to have like the electricity for a wheel to spin around.
Fair okay? enough.
It is impossible to say when the potter's wheel, which was a difficult tool and needs a long apprenticeship, debatable, was introduced. A pot cannot be made by hand modeling or coiling without the potter's either turning it or moving it around, and turning involves the least expenditure of human effort. It would obviously be preferred. Mm-hmm. The development of slow or hand-turned wheel was an adjunct to a pottery manufacturer, led eventually to introduction of the kick wheel rotated by foot, which became the potter's principal tool. The potter throws the clay into a rapidly rotating disc and shapes his pot by manipulating it with both hands. This is a considerable feat of manual dexterity and leads to much greater exactness and symmetry of form. Perhaps the most skillful of all potters have been the Chinese.
Hmm.
Excellent examples of their virtuosity are the double gourd vases made from the 16th century onward, which were turned into separate sections and afterwards joined together. By the 18th century, the wheel was no longer necessarily turned by the potter's foot, but by small boys.
Oh, wow.
And since okay. the 19th century, the motive power had been mechanical. Electrical power was common in the 20th century, but many artisans continued to prefer foot.
Child labor. Like it.
I think electrical is probably the best in my
yeah.
opinion.
Yeah. Nice.
Probably that's the easier. Only one I've used. I've never used a manual foot.
Oh, really?
Foot power one
okay.
before.
Yeah.
I mean, electric being like they have the mm-hmm. foot pedal, but you like plug it into a wall.
Sure.
You know?
Sure. You're not like mechanically pressing down to make it spin. Like
correct. Yeah. Correct. But I mean, you do press the foot pedal, but it's powered. You don't have
right.
to continuously press it. It's like a gas accelerator. You
right.
Know?
Right.
Yeah. Jollying or jiggering is a mechanical adaptation of wheel throwing and is used where mass production or duplication of the same shape, particularly cups and plates, is required. The jolly or jigger was introduced during the 18th century. It is similar to the wheel in appearance, except that the head consists of plaster mold shaped like the inside of the object, such as a plate, and As it revolves, the interior of the plate is shaped by pressing the clay against the head, while the exterior, including the foot ring, is shaped by a profile, which is a flat piece of metal cut into the contour of the underside of the plate, brought into contact with the clay. Machines that make both cups and plates automatically on this principle were introduced in the 20th century. Small parts such as cup handles are made separately by pressing clay into molds and are subsequently attached to the vessel by luting.
Nice.
One of the earliest methods of shaping clay was molding. Pots were also made by smearing clay around the inside of a basket or coarsely woven sack. The matrix was consumed during firing, leaving the finished pot with the impression of the weave of the on the exterior. A more advanced method used by the Greeks and others is to press the pottery body into molds of fired clay. Though the early molds were comparatively simple, they later became more complex, and a tendency best seen in those molds used for manufacture of the pottery figures. The unglazed earthenware figures of Tanagra, which is central Greece, were first molded by hand, and then molds of whole figures were used, and finally the components, arms, legs, heads, and torsos were all molded separately. And they're talking about a pot, not a person, just saying.
Thank you for clarifying.
The pots were often regarded as interchangeable, so that a variety of models could be constructed for a limited number of components. No improvement on this method of manufacture had been devised by the 20th century. The European porcelain factories made their figures in precisely the same way.
Fancy.
Plaster of Paris molds were introduced to Shepherdshire about 1745. They enabled vessels to be cast in slip. For when the slip was poured into a mold, the plaster absorbed the water from it, thus leaving a layer of clay on the surface of the mold. When this layer had reached a sufficient length and thickness, the surplus slip was poured off, the cast removed and fired, and the mold used again. This method still in common use.
I actually watch a girl on TikTok that uses those molds.
Oh, neat.
Yeah, to like pour it all in, and you get to watch the whole process. And then when it sets, it's like magically in the shape after she's poured out like everything.
Yeah.
It's very impressive.
It's very cool. Yeah. My preferred method, I think, is just like wheel throwing and then firing it. I don't know.
I've never done a pottery class, but it always looks very fun. I would also like to say that she is not throwing clay violently around the room. It is physically on a wheel, and it is called throwing.
That is the verb. Yes.
It's just Blair in the room, just yeeting
I mean,
clay.
That would be really therapeutic, to be honest.
Probably.
But like, you know, do what you, yeah. Anyway, so we're going to take a little break, and we're going to talk about fire and how we do that and decorating after this.
So fun.
This ad is an actual ad. However, we will still not be benefiting from this. This is an ad for our Twitch stream. You can watch us do a live podcast every other Thursday. Come hang out and interact with us and maybe catch a Pokemon or two. And maybe, just maybe, learn something. But honestly, the chances are slim. Catch us on Twitch at 6 p.m. EST or 3 p.m. PST. Or a different time in a different time zone that is not in the United States.
We would love to chat with you, and definitely let us know if you are an OG audio listener. Now, back to the regular audio pre-recorded podcast. Cheers! Also, don't forget to rate us 5 stars. Okay, now back to the pod. Welcome back.
It's like a welcome. The thing is, sometimes we talk in between, but sometimes we literally take a break, have a snack, pee our pants, and then we come back.
Right.
Yeah.
So change like, said pants, obviously.
Oh. Well, then I might.
Well,
need
if we're
break.
Peeing our pants, we need to change them afterwards, right?
Well, all right. Well, yeah. Thanks for telling me now. Anyway.
Oh, okay. All right.
Pottery.
So we're going to talk about firing. To do that, So you throw, like, let's say you have your wheel, you make your pot. I'm not going to go through the steps of that because, like, it's really hard to explain in an audio format. And I feel like it would just be better if you took a pottery class and just had a little cozy hobby for the winter. But anyway, do what you want. So to get to the point of firing, you have to let your clay dry for a little bit. So you can't just go straight from throwing the pottery on the wheel and then, like, sticking it in the kiln because there's too much water and then your pot will explode.
Fun.
So just keep that in mind. So newly shaped articles were formed were formally allowed to dry slowly in the atmosphere. And in the 20th century pottery factories, this stage was sped up by the introduction of automatic dryers, often in the form of hot, dry tunnels, which the ware passes on a conveyor belt. Now, I have never used one of these. This is, like, from a manufacturing standpoint, I'm pretty sure.
Makes sense, yeah.
If you're just making your own pottery, like, in a class or in your garage or, like, whatever it is, you usually just let them chill for a couple of days. And then you do something called trimming, which is the process of finishing the greenware, which is unfired pottery.
Fair. Okay. Sure.
After it is dried to a leather hardness. So dry enough to where when you pick it up, you don't make any fingerprints, but, like, still soft. So you have to be careful. The technique is used to smooth and finish the foot rings. So when you take it off of the, depending on how good you are, right?
Sure.
When you take it off of the wheel, typically the underside, if you want to make, like, a pretty little foot ring around, or if you want to just clean up the extra pottery around or trim it so it's not as heavy, you know, then you would trim it on the wheel. So you turn your pot upside down and you just work on the underside. Again, easier to do than to be explained in an audio format.
Fair enough.
But it's usually done on a potter's wheel, like we said. And usually there is, like, a tool that you use to, like, trim the outside.
Sure. Okay.
The earliest vessels, which were sun-dried but not fired, could be used only for storing cereals, which is probably, like, grains and stuff, not like Cocoa Puffs.
Maybe.
And similar dry materials. If a sun-dried clay vessel is filled with water, it absorbs that liquid and becomes soft again. So you can't,
right,
you know, use it for, like, you know, drinking glasses or something like that, right? If it is heated, the chemical changes, which we kind of talked about, preclude a return to its plastic state, quote unquote. After thoroughly drying, the pottery is fired in a kiln. In early pottery making, the objects were simply stacked in a shallow depression or a hole in the ground, and then they built a fire over top.
Makes
and that
sense.
Heat would seal, like, make them go through the chemical change and seal them.
Nice.
Later, coal or wood fire ovens became most universal. And in the 20th century, both gas and electricity were used as fuel, obviously. Many improvements were made in the design of intermittent kilns in which the ware is stacked when cold and then raised to the desired temperature. These kilns were extravagant of fuel, however, and were awkward to fill or empty if they didn't have time to cool completely. So this was very time consuming.
For sure.
So for these reasons, they were replaced by continuous kilns, the most economical and successful of which was the tunnel kiln. In these kilns, the wares were conveyed slowly from a comparatively cool region at the entrance to the full heat in the center. And as they neared the exit after firing, they cooled gradually.
Smart.
Again, I think that's more from, like, a manufacturing
For sure.
standpoint.
Yeah.
The type of kilns that you would see, like, in a regular pottery class are ones that are more, like, electric based, where it's totally cool.
Yeah.
And then you put your pieces in, you let it fire. And it takes, like, a certain amount of time.
and then you turn it, like, turns off, and then you have to let it cool for a certain amount of time, and mm-hmm. then you pull it out and it's done. And this can this is a process of like several days, right?
Yeah.
For like a regular person.
Right.
So yeah. Makes and there's sense. Many different kinds of kilns too. You can get like cool different, like depending on how you want to fire your pieces, there's like mm-hmm. different ways to do it to create different results. And it's a whole science. This article was like 47 pages long.
Woo.
So like go look it up. There's much more detail if you're interested. So yeah. The atmosphere in the kiln at the time of firing, as well as the composition of the clay body, I think this is probably what I just said, determines the color of the fired earthenware pot. Iron is ubiquitous in earthenware clay, and under the usual firing conditions, it oxidizes, giving the color ranging from buff, which is like a light, mm-hmm. like skin color, to, or I guess I should say like Caucasian skin color.
Sure.
to dark red, according to the amount present. Mm-hmm. In a reducing atmosphere, i.e. one where a limited supply of air causes the presence of carbon monoxide, the iron gives a color varying from gray to black, although the dark color may also occur as a result of the action of smoke. Mm. Both of the colors that result from iron in the clay can be seen in the black topped vases of the pre-dynastic Egypt.
Fancy.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. Even though it originated in China, the Egyptians oh, yeah. did some great pottery, and oh, like yeah. they knew how to build things, i.e. the pyramids. Mm-hmm. So, mm-hmm. you know.
And like you said, it's the oldest, like one of the oldest pieces right. of anyone's history that we've ever found first in most cases.
Truly.
It just lasts yeah. so long.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing I'll say, now we're going to talk about decorating. So we're going to transition. Some decorating happens before you fire. Some you have to fire first and then decorate and then fire again. If you've ever been to one of those like pick and paint pottery places where yeah. you like pick out a mug that's already been done and you paint it. Mm-hmm. Those mugs have already been fired once, and then you paint it and then they fire it again.
Yeah.
Or you can just like, I don't know. I've never actually done one of those before, but like
we have, it's fun.
Do they fire it for you again, or do you just take it home?
Oh no, they fire it for you again.
You again. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's what I thought. Okay. Yeah.
You paint it with
right.
the glazes that they have.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's what I thought. I wasn't sure.
Yeah. They okay. had it at like, I don't know if they still do. I know they have like the candle things because everybody wants to do like the candle dipping and stuff like that. But
oh, yeah.
They actually had it at Busch Gardens.
I
don't
really?
Know they, yeah. I don't know if they oh, still
wait,
do.
They did in like the country
yeah.
area, like where the log flume was.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Cause I mm-hmm. have a unicorn that I did.
Yeah.
Like from that time frame. Just yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah. We I don't never know if they did that, it, but I remember but... wanting to. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. It was very fun. And it was also, I think that day it ended up raining. So it was also perfect for my mom to be like, do something.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, my hair for 2 minutes.
That's right.
Fair enough.
Cool. Okay, so the first decorating type we're going to talk about is impressing and stamping. So even the earliest pottery was usually embellished in one way or another. One of the earliest methods of decoration was to make an impression in the raw clay. So this would happen before you fire it, obviously. Mm-hmm. Finger marks were sometimes used, as well as impressions from rope or from a beater bound with straw. basket work patterns were also found on pots molded over baskets, which is cool.
Yeah.
And are sometimes imitated on pots made by other methods. So
And if you're stamping your name or like your mm-hmm. like your mark, that's mm-hmm. probably also where this happens.
Yes. Yeah. And usually potters will mm-hmm. sign on the bottom either with like a tool or they have mm-hmm. like a stamp already pre-made.
Mm-hmm.
the second type is applique, which is the addition of separately molded decoration. So applied ornament, I guess, is another way to say it, such as knobs or like the reliefs on Wedgwood jasperware mm-hmm. Came somewhat later. So the
Earliest known examples are found on Mediterranean pottery made at the beginning of the first millennium. Raised designs are also produced by pressing out the wall of the vessel from the inside, as the Roman pottery known as terra sigillata, a technique that resembles a repoussé method adopted by metal workers.
Cute.
So I would also think that this covers like applying a handle to a mug, that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. So you have to do this thing called scoring so say you're scoring a handle for a mug, you have to take a fork or like whatever you want, really, and draw a bunch of lines, kind of make like a crisscross pattern, and that allows the handle to attach to the base of the mug part. They're like the main mug part. Yeah. And it makes all the nice little particles of the clay stick together very nicely. We love that.
So again, done prior to the first fire in most cases.
In most cases. Yeah. In most cases, because they need that adhesiveness. Mm-hmm. Okay. So then there's incising, graffito, carving, and piercing. That would be number three. So the earliest decoration was incised into raw clay with a pointed stick or with the thumbnail. So chevrons, with being a particularly common motif, incised designs on a dark body were sometimes filed or filled with lime, which effectively accents the decoration. Examples can be seen in some of the early work from Cyprus and in some comparatively modern work. Decoration engraved after its firing is much less usual, but the skillful and accomplished engraving on one fine Egyptian pot. Oh my gosh. Sorry. Jinx just like knocked something over. Okay.
Of course.
Scared me. But the skillful and accomplished engraving on one fine Egyptian pot of the pre-dynastic period suggests that the practice may have been more frequent than was previously suggested. Originally, defects of body color suggested the use of slip, either white or colored, as a wash over the vessel before firing. A common mode of decoration is to incise a pattern through the slip, revealing the differently colored body beneath. A technique called graffito, which is scratched, graffito ware was produced by Islamic potters and became common through the Middle East. The 18th century scratched blue class of English white stoneware is decorated with graffito patterns, usually touched with blue. So nice. I've never done this particular procedure, but it seems pretty cool. Yeah, Kirsten, you're going to look that up for me.
I am. Good. Perfect. Literally was like, I got to look that up.
Slip carving is another technique that's kind of related to the graffito one. The clay body is covered with a thick coating of slip, which is carved out with a knife. And slip, just a reminder, is a little bit of watered down clay. So it's kind of, and like, you can make it thicker to create little designs like with the slip, or you can use it more of like a glaze situation, which is carved out with a knife, leaving raised design in slip. Slip carving was done by Islamic and Chinese potters.
It is very unique in its design and like how it's done, like this scraffito, where it's very... Like if you're looking at other pottery, it's very obvious
which
kind
ones
of style
are
it is. Yeah.
Yeah. Cool.
Yeah.
So we're gonna talk a little bit more about slip decorating, because it is a major way to decorate your pot. I've done that before, and the earliest forms of decoration in ancient Egypt, for example, were animal and scenic motifs painted in white slip on a red body of clay.
Nice.
Right. And in the North American Indian cultures, and this also happens pre-firing, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
In North American Indian cultures, colored slips provided the material for much of the painted freehand decoration. Slip, too, is sometimes dotted and trailed in much the same way as confectioner decorates a cake with icing sugar. The English slipwares of the 17th and 18th century are typical of this kind of work. Earthenware washed over with a white slip and covered with colorless glaze is sometimes difficult to distinguish from ware covered with a tin glaze. In consequence, it has sometimes been wrongly called faience, which is the term for French earthenware covered with a transparent glaze.
Ah.
And in Germany, it's called Steingut, which is, and Mesa Maiolica, which is Italy, and Halib, or Hibe, faience, refer to slip-covered earthenware with incised decoration. So there's many words for like all of these kinds of styles.
Which shows how vast it is,
yes.
I would say.
Yes. Yep.
Mm-hmm.
So slip is also used for combed wares. The marbled effect on Chinese pottery of the Tang Dynasty, for example, was sometimes achieved by mingling with a comb slips of contrasting colors after they have been put on the pot. The Koreans use slip for their buchejang inlay technique, which the Japanese called mishma. So everybody, again, has like a different name for all of these things.
Mm-hmm.
The designs were first incised into clay and the incisions were then filled with black and white slip.
Perfect. Nice.
Okay. Burnishing and polishing. When the clay used in early pottery was exceptionally fine, it was sometimes polished or burnished after firing. Such pottery dating back to 6500 and 2000 BCE has been excavated in Turkey and Banshan Cemetery in Gangsu Province, China.
Wow.
Most Inca pottery is red polished as well.
Nice. That's cool.
Decorative glazing. So this is, I think, typical of what you would see at like a pottery show. I mean, or that kind of thing. Decorative glazing is like early fired earthenware vessels held water, but because these vessels were slightly porous, the liquid percolated slowly into the outside where it evaporated and then cooling the contents of the vessel. Thus, the porosity of earthenware was and still is sometimes an advantage in hot countries. And the principle is still utilized in the 21st century in the construction of domestic milk and butter coolers and some food storage cupboards. Porosity, however, had many disadvantages. The vessel could not be used for storing wine or milk. And to overcome the porosity, some people applied varnishes of one kind or another. Varnished pots were made, for example, in Fiji. The more advanced technique is glazing. The fired object was covered with a finely ground glass powder, often suspended in water, and was then fired again. During the firing, the fine particles covering the surface infused an amorphous glass-like layer, sealing the pores of the clay body.
So smart, though.
Yeah, so smart. When you have glazes, like my art teacher in college, she had like several different buckets, like just 5 gallon buckets filled with the glaze, and you had to like stir it up with like a paint stirrer because it all like settles to the bottom because the sediment is like what creates the glass glaze. So it's really cool. The only thing I will say that if you're glazing something with a glaze like this, with that has like those glass elements, make sure you wipe the bottom of your pot off, because then it will stick. Once it hardens, it will stick to the bottom of the kiln, and your pottery instructor will be super mad at you, and it will be kind of dangerous for everyone.
That's lovely. I love that.
I had a couple of pieces in my college ceramics class, like kind of melt down onto the
shelf in the kiln.
Beautiful.
And she like popped it off for me and then like used a electric sander to like sand it down. So that was really nice of her, because otherwise I would not have been able to use it because it would be too sharp and dangerous. Mm-hmm. But it kind of looks a little janky. So just avoid it at all costs. Okay.
I think normally what they do is they just use a sponge and just gently wipe away the glaze on the.
Yes. On the when area. It's wet. Right. When it's wet. Yeah. Right. No, that's true.
Just be yes. careful, people.
Yeah. It's wild out there
in the pottery business.
It really is. Okay. So, except for tin glazed wares, earthenware's glaze was added to the biscuit clay body, which was then fired a second time at a lower temperature. Soft porcelain glaze was always applied in this way. Hard porcelain glaze was usually, and stoneware salt glaze always, fired at the same time as the raw clay body at the same high temperature. So glazes, you're always going to glaze the, or fire the pot and the glaze at the same time. You're never gonna like fire the pot and then put the glaze on. So basically there are four principal kinds of glazes: feldspathic, lead, tin, and salt. Now I'm imagining the lead kind we probably don't want to deal with, but that's
especially
just
if you're
me
trying to eat off of it.
Yeah, right. So like
when
I don't
make my
really
phone
know
China.
I am mad. Right. So I imagine the lead ones are probably not as fashionable.
Yeah.
Currently, but you also need to be aware if you're like antiquing for pottery, mm-hmm. test that for lead. Okay.
And if it has lead, don't eat off of it.
That's correct. I think anything after, I looked it up one time because we have these beautiful handmade plates that my grandmother passed down from me, like to me, because she bought them in Italy and they're all like ceramically handmade. They're beautiful and I love them so much. But I like kind of freaked out for a second because she bought them what I would assume would be like kind of in the 70s because that's when they lived there. And I was like, oh my God, are these made like before they like outlawed lead in pottery? And so I got like a little lead testing kit and everything, but I looked it up and typically everything after like 1960s, typically give or take, are usually fine, but just, you know, you can't ever be too sure. You just, and it's easy to get like a lead testing kit and like wipe it on there. So just do that.
Yeah. Also, just use the fine china.
Also that.
The end of the story.
If you can use
the fine china daily, use it because it's beautiful and it's sad not to use something so beautiful.
Right.
Side tangent.
Totally. Totally. All right. And then there's painting, which I think is pretty cool. Everybody kind of knows it's like a pick and paint situation,
For sure.
The earliest pottery colors appear to have been achieved by slips stained with various metallic oxides. At first, these were undoubtedly oxides that occurred naturally in the clay. Later, they were added from other sources. Until the 19th century, when pottery colors began to be manufactured on an industrial scale, the oxides commonly used in those of tin, cobalt, copper, iron, manganese, and antimony. Yikes. Tin oxide supplied a useful white, which was also used in making tin glazes and occasionally for painting. Cobalt blue, ranging in color from grayish blue to pure sapphire, was widely used in East Asia and Europe for blue and white porcelain wares. Cupric oxide gives a distinctive series of blues, cuprous oxide in a series of greens, and in the presence of excess of carbon monoxide, which the Chinese achieved by throwing wet wood into the kiln, cupric oxide yields a bluish red. This particular color is known as reduced copper, and the kiln is said to have a reducing atmosphere. The colors obtained from ferric iron range from pale yellow to black, the most important being slightly red-orange, referred to as iron red.
Ferrous iron yields green that can be seen as its best on a Chinese celadon wares. Manganese gives colors varying from bright red, purple, similar to the permanganate of potash, or a dark purplish brown that can be used almost as almost black. All right. So then we move on to transfer printing. The transfer print made from copper plate was first used in England in the 18th century. In the 20th century, transfers from copper plate were in common use for commercial wares, as well as lithographic and other processes such as silkscreen printing, which consists of rubbing the color through a pattern screen of textile material. Combinations of hand-painted and transfer decorations were often used. The outline or other part of the decoration was applied with a transfer print, and then parts of the design, such as leaves, flowers, clothing, or water, were painted in.
Fancy.
So I've used my art teacher in college had transfer paper that we could use, and she had like plenty of designs and stuff that we could use. And basically, you take your pre-fired pot, you cut out what you want in terms of design, and it's kind of like parchment paper, basically. What it kind of seems like. You put it in the pot, and then you take your wet sponge and you just dab 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 dab, and then you pull it off. It's like doing a temporary tattoo, kind of.
Except for pots
you pull it off, and then you glaze, and then it's fine.
Cute.
Yeah.
Love cute. That.
We liked it too.
And easy if you're not an artist. It's very easy.
Totally. Totally.
And you just want to put a design on it.
Yeah. All right. And then we're going to talk about marking, which we kind of touched on a little bit earlier. Most porcelain and much earthenware bears marks or devices for the purpose of identification. Stonewares, apart from those of Wedgwood, are not so often marked. Chinese porcelain marks usually record the dynasty and the name of the emperor, but great caution is necessary before accepting them at their face value. In the past, Chinese vendors frequently used the mark of an earlier reign as a sign of veneration, or the products of antiquity, and occasionally for financial gain. The majority of European factories adopted a device, for example, the well-known cross swords of Messian taken from the electoral arms of Saxony, or the royal monogram on Sevres porcelain.
Sure.
But these also cannot be regarded as a guarantee of authenticity. Not only are the false marks added to contemporary forgeries, but the smaller 18th century factories often copied the marks of the more august competitors. If 18th century European porcelain is signed with the artist's name, it generally means that the painting was done outside the factory. Permission to sign factory work was rarely given.
I mean, this is just the start of fraud.
Literally.
Really what this
well,
is.
And it's the same thing as art, right? Yeah. You have to like authenticate the art. And usually you can do that by noticing little discrepancies, looking at the signature, et cetera, right? Yeah.
And looking at the piece itself to try and figure out how old it actually is compared to when that person was around to sign it.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. So, as a final note, pottery making is not universal. It is rarely found among nomadic tribes, since potters must live within reach of their raw materials. Moreover, if there are gourds, skins, and similar natural materials that can be made into vessels without trouble, there's no incentive to make pottery in the ancient world, right? Yet pottery making is one of the most widespread and oldest of the crafts.
It also makes sense in terms of like nomadic is... some of them outside of function were obviously used as art. And if you're nomadic, you don't have a lot of room to carry a bunch of random art that you've made.
Well, and even like from a practical standpoint, if you're making bowls and stuff, like they didn't have the firing methods necessarily to like make it sustainable. So they would just break, and then you wasted all your time. Like, making this bowl, you know,
compared to materials that were already available, like you said, the gourds, skins that can, you know, repress oils and water,
right?
Keep things long. Yeah, it's less time consuming, you know, to core out a gourd than it is to spend a week on a pot, I guess.
Totally.
Yeah. But it is very cool how widespread it is.
I think so too. I think it kind of like, it's one of those arts that like kind of brings us together as like a humanity, I feel, because if you don't make pottery, you can definitely benefit or have benefited mm-hmm. from pottery in your life or used it, you know? And I like the functionality of a lot of it. I mean, not all of it, obviously sculpture and all that is different, but like that was one of my main reasons for getting into pottery is like, I just like the functionality of it.
No, it's very cool. It could be both. It could be one or the other. It's
yeah.
very versatile, and everyone's benefited from it because every civilization has had it and had some way to eat off of it as well in most cases.
True.
So
yeah,
we've all come from somewhere, you know?
Exactly.
And stay tuned for my line of bone china made from yours truly. Can you imagine? That's our merch. God. I just pass away and now all the MCP merch is just my bone china. Enjoy.
That's ridiculous. And I think Tyler would have none of it, honestly. Like that would be like say that I outlived you and like I'm like, Tyler, this is her dying wish, and he'd be like, absolutely not.
I'm gonna put it in my will.
No. I'm gonna have to carry out your bone china wish now. Thank you so
are.
Much.
My femur will go to my brother. My forearm shall go to you. You can have both forearms if you want.
Great. Forearm base. That's what I've always wanted.
I mean, it's kind of cute.
It is kind of cute.
I'm gonna give my ribs to Tyler.
I think that's reasonable.
I think so too. It's like the torso. It's what keeps y'all together, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, it's around your heart. Yeah.
Solid torso bones.
Yeah.
Anyway, I'm not an expert on bones.
Get your tail out of my yogurt. Jesus Christ.
Okay. I think that's it for today.
Yeah, that needs to be it. I'm done.
I'm not an expert on bone china or tail yogurt or pottery, but that's all fine because you probably aren't either, and you probably have questions, comments, most likely concerns, or episode topics for the future. You can send all of that stuff to us via email, mediocrecontentpodcast@gmail.com as usual, or slide over into our DMs on social via Instagram and TikTok at the exact same handle. We don't make it complicated because we're uncomplicated, and it was easy enough just to have the same handle for everything. Also, rate us 5 stars wherever you listen to podcasts. We appreciate you listening to our podcast, and we will see you next week.
This has been Mediocre Content.
Thanks so much for listening.
Cheers.
Cheers.
Thank you.